as we finish up this powerful lesson on your servant Solomon. Lord, just guide us, direct us, and I pray that your message would come through clearly today, and we will praise your name. Amen. Well, we've been following the story of Solomon, and we come to the end of his story today. Were you surprised? I was really surprised with the story of Solomon. The first 10 chapters actually deal with the first half of his reign. At that time, he's doing so wonderful. Remember, he was about 20 years old when he took over as king. And the first thing he did was to offer sacrifices to the Lord and to honor him. And the Lord came to him in a dream and asked him what he could do for him. And he said, I'd like wisdom or a discerning heart in order to govern your people wisely. And God was delighted with him. And he said, I will give you wisdom beyond anything anybody's ever dreamed of. Plus, I will give you great wealth, fame, and honor. The next 13 years, he's busy building. Takes him to about the 20-year point. First, he builds the temple of the Lord. And then he builds his own palace. And you remember at the end of the time that he completed his palace, he dedicated that again to the Lord. And the Lord came and appeared to Solomon a second time and said that he had heard his prayers and that he would put his name on the temple and that he would reside there. His eyes and his heart would always be upon the temple and upon his city, Jerusalem. But he warned Solomon, he says, but remember to obey all my commandments. Solomon was becoming very wealthy. He was world-renowned. And the more he got, the more he had to protect it. And we open up today's chapter with a surprising verse. He loved many foreign wives. Many? 700 of them? That's many. Plus 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. I can't imagine what this man... Well, we won't go there. What was he doing? He was protecting all his stuff because he was creating treaties. And I want to show you how this occurs. First off, we all know that he married the Pharaoh's daughter, right? So we've got Egypt here, and it says he married royal princesses from Edom. We've got Edom here. Pop quiz. Who's Edom descended from? Esau, Jacob's twin brother Esau. He married Moabite and Ammonite women. Who are they descended from? Lot. Abraham's nephew Lot. So he married Ammonites. He married women from Aram, from Phoenicia. Here's Sidon and Tyre. Incidentally, one of his wives was King Hiram's daughter. Also the Hittites, which is up around here. Do you see what he's doing? He's married wives all around here. What is he doing? He's protecting his trade, because if you're down in Egypt and you want to trade up here, over here, you got to go through here. And if you're here and you want to trade here, you got to go through here. So what is he doing? He's making treaties with all these rulers, and the way they were bound was with marriage to their royal wives. That way, his trade routes would always be open, because trade was his life. It said he loved many wives. I know a little bit about love. I've been married, what, coming on 33 years. Love takes time and a lot of work. I don't see how you can love 1,000. I don't think it's possible. So I had to go into the Hebrew to see what this word love means. First off, it's ahab, A-H-A-B. It meaning is to have affection for sexually. I thought, oh, well, that fits. These are all the royals. They're the best of the best. So he has all these beautiful princesses being given to him. So he had affection for them sexually. But for the first time, we find him measured against his father David. And what do we read? He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. You see, God's teaching was very clear on this. They were not to intermarry with these foreign women. And you're going, now, wait a minute. What about Rahab? And what about Ruth? They were foreign women. The difference was that those foreign women put away their gods and accepted the God of Israel. These foreign women brought their gods with them. And God had been very specific. You saw that in your lesson today. They were to totally wipe out these foreign gods because they were detestable. Some of your translations say abomination to the Lord. What that means is they take what God has designed and pervert it, abuse it, or destroy it. And we find out that that's exactly what was happening. You see, Solomon his heart was being turned by these foreign women. He had to keep his wives happy in order to keep their fathers happy in order to keep his trade treaties going. And so in order to do that, he brought their gods. It said he put them east of Jerusalem. You know where east of Jerusalem is? It's on the Mount of Olives. Where would Solomon get the money to fund all this? From the people he was taxing for the nation of Israel? What was the purpose of Israel's placement there? So the whole world would know that he alone is God. What did he do? He built high places, shrines to the detestable gods of the Canaanites. The first goddess is Asherah. Now she's the fertility goddess. And I thought, how appropriate, with 1,000 wives, they were praying to the fertility goddess, because their only purpose as a wife was to bear a son. But her practice was detestable. In order to have this, they had to have an altar, they had to have a priest and priestess, and in order to reach Asherah so that she would make him fertile, they would go through this practice of public intercourse, and then they would go into the temples and do likewise with a priest or priestess, whoever it was. God said that was detestable. Incidentally, if you've got worship of Asherah, it's not long before you have worship of Baal. It's starting with the women in Asherah, it will move to Baal, and we'll see that as we continue. God said that was evil, but the one he said was detestable was Molech and Chemosh. They're brothers. Their worship is the same. This one makes me sick to my stomach. In order to have this, you had to have a bronze idol that you could heat up his arms red hot, and they passed the children through the fire. That meant they brought their children, placed them in the arms. And God said this was an abomination and detestable. What is Solomon doing? The very thing that God had said was to be removed so it would not influence his people, so that he could influence them, being the one true God, Solomon has now brought back into the Israelite culture and reintroduced it through these foreign women that they were to destroy. Now, one thing about the Old Testament is it presents its characters as they are, not as they ought to be. And we learn from them both from their poor examples as well as their godly examples. But we see that God was angry with Solomon. You can see, I mean, we say, oh, why should they wipe out those nations? Imagine what they were doing. And that's not even the half of it. That's just what we can depict. God says in verse 11, since you have not kept my commandment and have disobeyed my laws, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your servants. But for the sake of your father David, I will not do this while you are still alive. I will take the kingdom away from your son. And even so, I will let him be king of one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, my chosen city. How is he going to take the kingdom away? He's going to tear it away. That's not a nice sounding word. And who's he giving it to? Some outside foreign power that's going to come in? No, he's going to give it to a servant. But you see, God has an unconditional covenant with David, his father, because David's heart was fully turned towards the Lord. And in 2 Samuel 7:12, he said to David, when you die, I will raise up one of your descendants, and I will make his kingdom strong. He is the one who will build a house, a temple for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. And when he does wrong, I will use other nations to punish him. But my unfailing love will not be taken from him as I took it from Saul, whom I removed before you. Your dynasty and your kingdom will continue for all time before me, and your throne will be secure forever. So David had a two-pronged covenant, an unconditional one based on nothing that David and his descendants did, and then a conditional one based on obedience. In the case of Solomon, he was the one that God chose to build his temple, and God said he would never take his spirit from him. He would remain with him, but he would discipline him when he did wrong. Did you hear how he would discipline him? With foreign nations, with other nations. And so we come to the consequences of Solomon's sins. He starts with a man named Hadad. Incidentally, Hadad is a title. For those of you, we picked it up in Leaders yesterday. Didn't we have a Hadad back in Genesis? Yes, and you're going to have a Hadad all the way to Malachi. Hadad is a title like King Pharaoh. So we have this young man named Hadad, and his story goes back to the time of David. David was conquering that area, and in 1 Chronicles 18, we read that he had come against the Edomites, and they had killed 18,000 of them. When you're reading your text, it sounds like Joab goes in and for 6 months he wipes out every male Edomite. Actually, what they did is they went in battle and they killed every warrior that was in battle, every Edomite. And Joab has to go back and it takes him 6 months to bury the dead. And while he's doing that, he's setting up garrisons and making them subject to King David at the time. But when it looked like the Edomites were going to lose, the young prince, named, we'll call him Hadad, was spirited away by some of his father's royal officials and taken down to Egypt. Now, I thought that was interesting. And notice that the Egyptian pharaoh takes him in, provides a home, land, food for him. Why would he take him in? Well, because Israel's starting to be an up-and-coming power. And Egypt is down here, and they trade up here and over here. So any kingdom that can help control Israel is important to him. So he takes him in because in the future he hopes he will be a potential ally to him. He acts as a father in that he provides a wife, but he also acts as a pharaoh to a king with a royal wife, which becomes a treaty then between the two of them. And we notice that as time goes on, David and Joab die, and Hadad finds out about it. And I think he probably watched Solomon for a while to see whether or not it was safe to go back. And then he asked permission to go back from the pharaoh. And did you notice what the pharaoh said this time? He said, "Why would you want to go? Haven't I provided you everything?" You see, Pharaoh doesn't want him going back because he's got a bone to pick. His whole family, his whole tribe was wiped out by Israel. And he's going to go back and make trouble. But what does Pharaoh have with Solomon? He's got a treaty. Solomon's his son-in-law, so he doesn't want him really going back and causing trouble. But he eventually allows him to go back. And it says he causes Solomon trouble all his days. Why does he cause Solomon trouble? You remember he's got ships? And his ships sail right here from Ezon Geber, right here on the Gulf of Aqaba. And here's Edom. So he's causing havoc with the trade route down there. The other one that's mentioned is Rezon. David is trying to get up to the Euphrates River up here. And so he's moving north. He comes past Gesher here up to the area where the king of Zobah, what Hadadezer is. And as he's coming north, Damascus and Aram is right here. So he joins together with Zobah, which is right here, because he knows he's next. And David wipes out 22,000 of them in that battle. Well, there's a rebel there called Rezon. He was part of Hadadezer's army, and like David, broke away from Saul and took with him a group of rebels. And while they're fighting David down here, he goes up into Damascus, where the king of Aram has left, and he actually conquers the city and declares himself king. Now, the only battle that we have recorded at all with Solomon is right here at Hadath-Zobah, and it probably was fighting against Rezon. But do you notice what's happening here? You've got a rebel force right here in Damascus. What does that do with the trade route? It affects the northern trade route. Solomon's life was trade. And God used that because he had put his faith and his trust in his wealth and these foreign gods. The last one, though, was the most powerful threat, and that came from within. A man by the name of Jeroboam. And he was a constant threat. He comes from the tribe of Ephraim. He goes to work at the terrace at Jerusalem. Solomon's in his building projects. What he's doing is expanding the city because it's got sharp cliffs, so he's building terraces so they go out. He's actually building up the area between Zion and the Temple Mount because there's a valley in between, so he's making it level there. And he's informed that there's one hard worker that's a great leader, and his name is Jeroboam. And Jeroboam then becomes the head over forced labor for the house of Joseph. Who's the house of Joseph? We don't have any tribe named Joseph. Ephraim and Manasseh, you remember that story? Joseph's sons are Ephraim and Manasseh. And when we took the tribe of Levi out of the inheritance in order to still make the 12 tribes, they went from Joseph to his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So what Jeroboam is doing is he's now the head foreman over the two tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, said by the house of Joseph. Now, I thought about this because if you think back to our time of Judges, who was the lead tribe? Ephraim. Ephraim was the head tribe. They are now conscripted labor. They were drafted 1 month on, 2 months at home, 1 month on, 2 months home. This is hard labor. They're building terraces, walls, filling in things. And I have a feeling that Jeroboam was going around talking to his tribesmen, and he was hearing a lot of complaining. You know, here we are facing this daily task of this heavy labor because Solomon's king. Now, if we'd have still had the kingship, if we were still the rulers, it wouldn't be that way. One day he's leaving Jerusalem, and he runs into a prophet coming from Shiloh, which is about 30 miles north. And somebody's wearing a new robe. Did you figure that out in your group today? Couldn't figure out if it was Hijah that was wearing the new robe or Jeroboam. You saw when I wrote the material, I thought it was Jeroboam that was wearing the new robe. I went back yesterday and did some more research, and I think I have come to a tentative, definitive answer. I think it's Ahijah that's wearing the new robe, and the reason I do, when they changed from an apprentice to a full prophet or an apprentice to a full priest, they were given a new robe. And if that is so, then that would have been a new prophet that was meeting Jeroboam. It doesn't make any difference. I want you to picture this with me. Okay, Jeroboam's coming out of Jerusalem, probably heading home. His month is up. He gets to go home for 2 months. Ahijah's coming up the other direction, stops him, takes off this coat, and rips it into 12 pieces. A new coat. The law, according to the book of Numbers, is that if you had to take somebody's coat for collateral for a loan, you had to return it at night to keep them warm, because chances are you only had one coat. They didn't go to the closet and have a choice. The big thing about getting married was they got new clothes. They had generally one set. So here he is with a new one, tearing it. Verse 33, Ahijah says to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hands and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. Notice what he says. He's holding them. What does he tell them to do? Take it. God's not going to hand you the kingdom, Jeroboam. You've got to take it, because it's going to be torn away from the house of Solomon. But he also warns them. He says, I am not going to give you all of them. I'm going to retain one tribe for my servant David, so that his light won't go out. And a light is lineage. When your light goes out, that's the end of it. It can be a personal life, or it could be a lineage. He says David's life is not going to go out, but he's to take 10 of the tribes. He goes on and tells them exactly why. Verse 33, I will do this because they, meaning the house of Solomon, have forsaken me and worship Asheroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. Jeroboam, do you hear that? I've got this graphic illustration, ripping the robe. Now you take 10 out of my hand. And the reason you're going to do this is because he went after false gods. Idol worship. Do you get that? Is that clear? I want this to cement in our minds, because we're going to see what happens as we continue on. It's very clear to Jeroboam. I have a feeling it's embedded in his mind, because it was a graphic illustration. Then he goes on to say the most amazing thing I've read in Scripture yet, I think. Verse 37, however, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all of your heart's desire. You will be king over Israel, if you do whatever I command, and walk in my ways, and do what is right in my eyes, by keeping my statutes and commands as David my servant did. I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and give Israel to you. And I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. Do you hear what he's doing? He's making the same covenant with Jeroboam that he made with David and Solomon. I don't know if I've read this before, but I never noticed that before. What was God saying? God's saying we can have two dynasties here. We could have the house of David following me, and we could have the house of Jeroboam following me forever. But they're both conditional. It's based on obedience. Jeroboam had everything to gain. He didn't do anything but be a good builder on a wall. And look what God is doing for him. What an opportunity he's given him. God also said that he was going to humble David's descendants, but not forever. God has an unconditional promise. One tribe will always remain with the house of David because it's through that tribe that the Messiah will come. That was God's plan from the beginning. That will not change. So we're going to follow that story as we continue on. Well, Ahijah had come to Jeroboam in secret. If you notice, it was very clear to tell you nobody was on the road. It was only the two of them. But the next thing we find, Solomon's trying to kill him. Somehow word got out. Now, I didn't read all of the verse, but Ahijah was very clear. He was telling it, it's not going to be during Solomon's lifetime. It's going to be during his sons because of this promise I have with David. I have a feeling that Jeroboam went all the way back to work and said, guess what, guys? We're going to have a new kingdom, and I'm going to be king. They probably rose up together because it said he rebelled. And Solomon tries to kill him. And where does Jeroboam flee? To Egypt. Amazing. And the Pharaoh, who now has a new name, who is not the father-in-law of Solomon, takes him in. Why? What kind of a nation is Israel now under the rule of Solomon? Who controls the trade routes? Who's in control of everything? Israel. Pharaoh is very much interested in a change of dynasty in there. If he can have a treaty with Jeroboam, his trade routes are open again. And so he gladly takes Jeroboam in. And he says he remains there until Solomon dies. And then the death of Solomon is recorded very briefly, very succinctly. Very little is told. His wisdom and his account is recorded in the annals of the kings. Incidentally, they have not been found. We're not sure exactly what they are. I found two possibilities. They could be the official court records that were kept at Jerusalem, which would have been destroyed in 70 AD. Or it could have been records kept by the prophets of the deeds of the kings. Could be one or the other. We're not 100% sure, but they did exist. And a lot of Kings is based on that. And you will find reference to them throughout Scripture. It also says he was buried with his father David in his tomb. And he was succeeded by his son Rehoboam. And that's it. His reign. We get 10 for the first 20 years. How did that happen? This king had such promise. God had given him wisdom beyond anything anybody could imagine. But he got caught up in his stuff. And he started to compromise. Just a little bit here and a little bit there. Now, God had promised that he would give him peace on every side. It was God's responsibility, he said, to make sure that Israel was safe. And yet Solomon decided he had to have treaties. And he gained foreign wives that led him into idolatry, just as God had warned him over and over and over again. Now, we have a lot of Solomon's writing. He wrote many of the Psalms, the book of Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs. So I'd encourage you at least to read Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs when you've got his story fresh in your mind. But I'd like you to turn to Ecclesiastes now. That's about the middle of your Bible. And I'd like you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. What was it this wise king, the wisest of everyone, learned? We're going to begin with verse 24. Are you there? Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. And most profound. Who can discover it? So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate, and to search out wisdom in the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. I found more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap, and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but a sinner she will ensnare. Look, says Teacher Solomon, this is what I have discovered. Adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things, while I was still searching but not finding, I found one upright or honest man among a thousand, but not one upright or honest woman among them all. This only have I found. God made mankind to be upright and honest, but man has gone in search of his many schemes. Thousand. I wonder if he's reflecting on there's not one in his whole harem. Incidentally, I forgot to mention a harem. In antiquity, we think a thousand wives is just mind-boggling, and it is. But in antiquity, the more important the king, the more he had in his harem. David had 15, which Solomon would have inherited. But 1,000 was not the record. fact, it was quite common in antiquity. The record stands at 3,000 for an Egyptian pharaoh. But Solomon has discovered that there's not one honest woman among them. And even though man was created to be upright and honest and righteous, he goes in search of scheming. I wonder if that reflected himself. This is what this great and wise king is discovering with all his wisdom. But I want you to turn to the end of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 12, beginning in the middle of verse 13, and find out what was Solomon's bottom line at the end of life. He says, "Now all that has been heard, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commands. For this is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil." Solomon, all his great wisdom that God had given him, finally came to the conclusion, fear God, reverence him, honor him, and obey him. And that's what's life about. What did God tell him before he said he would give him wisdom? Fear God, honor, and obey. What had he given Abraham in Genesis, Moses, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy? What are you and I given in this entire book? Fear God and obey him. This great wise king came full circle to what God had told him in the beginning, and in the meantime found that there was no one else that he could trust but God. I hope you'll sit down and reflect on the life of Solomon. I was really surprised, because the only thing I ever think about Solomon is his temple and his great wisdom, but I didn't realize what happened to him at the end of his life.